Listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. I went through a bit of a dark patch in my late 20s. I don't know if it's natural or necessary for one to turn so extravagantly against oneself for a time. A perverse urge for self-destruction, which urge itself seems the last bit of evidence one needs to bring the axe down. But yet, while finding myself guilty and worthy of execution, I'd lacked the furnishings and temperament of an executioner. To my sense of ill-being, on August 16th, 1963, in the fishing port of Phan Thiet in Vietnam, came a self-immolating Buddhist monk who poured gasoline over his robes and lit himself on fire with a match. I was so taken with this, so bothered and absorbed by it, that 2 weeks later, on September 1st, I attempted to enlist in the army, that I might be allowed to travel to this profane or holy location, and perhaps, through osmosis, be met up with my own end. It was partly that I had a deep personal experience with fire, but it was also the paradoxically repulsive and sacred composition of the act, an ugly thing on the face, and even ugly underneath. But something exercised my darkly pining mind, and I was able to see in the death a kind of nightmare of beauty. Something simple and clear and to the point, and not death at all. And it drew me like a siren song. My application for military service was, as I supposed it would be, turned down for certain disqualifying features of my cauterized anatomy. But the recruiter informed me of a special non-fighting operations group that would, if I passed their psychological and intelligence-based examinations, take me. I was led to understand that joining this support group, which went by the impractically bland name of the National Corps, might possibly get me to Vietnam. And still under the luring spell of the monk of Phan Thiet, I submitted myself to the testing. A 15-minute, one-problem puzzle that required the organization and arrangement of a group of symbols into a proper order. A brain teaser, nothing more. This was followed by a 10-minute Rorschach inkblot test, which was carried out by a man whose primary pose was that of hovering sleep. I don't know if I did well on either or failed, but nonetheless, I was accepted into the National Corps. I had 3 months training at Fort Alert, curiously located on the northern tip of Ellesmere Island, the most northerly of the Canadian Arctic Islands, in the territory of Nunavut, just 450 nautical miles from the North Pole itself. Ellesmere Island is a hellaciously cold, desolate smear of ice. CFS Alert, as it is now known, was firstly inhabited by employees of the Joint Arctic Weather Station, which was run by both the Canadian Department of Transport and the United States Weather Bureau. What was originally an airfield and small cluster of buildings that permitted advanced weather monitoring by a wintry hardship crew had become, by the time I arrived, a cryptographic and military enclave where radio transmissions from Moscow were intercepted and decoded. My first training regimen involved listening and tracking various signal charges, the variety and timing of certain fluctuating radio frequencies, and the concomitant methods of transmission blocking that the Soviets may or may not have employed. I believed and was led to understand that this might lead to a transitional posting in Eastern Europe, which could then possibly lead to Vietnam. And, just to note it, as these things work, as soon as I had established myself as a member of what seemed a purposeful group, I lost a good deal of what had seemed my guiding intention. Instead of discovering a way to die, I had found a way to live. More often than not, I've discovered that where the cliché goes, I go too. There were a dozen of us flown to Fort Alert, and after the initial training period, we were trimmed down. Six men were lopped and cargoed off on a C-130. Of the six remaining at Fort Alert, four continued on the crypto-communication track, while I alone was sent into an archival and collections repository, a small, awful, cold metal building with a gas lamp and ice floor. My new training related to something that I was apparently quite gifted in, cladistics, the natural intuitive detecting of organizational hierarchies. I am not proud of this. Who could be? To be good at arranging information seems so much inferior to the analyzing or hypothesizing on it, the code work and secret detecting and broad speculating that was going on elsewhere in the compound, that I actually felt as though my stupidity had been finally certified. I felt myself to be the camp dunce slipping about in my ridiculous floor of ice library. I was set to work in my little repository to conceive of and create a data bank whereby an incredibly vast amount of military equipment, both old and new, as recorded on old yellowy slips of paper, could be organized into an accessible system of retrieval in the best fashion possible. To put this simply, I was a librarian of objects charged with the task of coming up with something like the Dewey Decimal System, an archivalist forced to find relationships between things based on derived or perceived similarities. This strange element to my task was that I often had no idea what the object I was classifying was. Who could know without being told what a K-17N double expander was? Of course, it became obvious I had better first read through the mind-numbing pile of nonsense scraps to become as widely familiar with as much of it as I could. Which is how I learned, in the mosaic of interpolation, that the K-17N double expander was a piece of tank weaponry which could be, if the tank became inoperable, separated from the carapace and still used as a shoulder-borne weapon. Still, there was not much information on any one card, and there were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of objects that remained absolute enigmas. Yet I was not to worry about this. The important thing was the manner in which I worked, my method, not whether my system could be assignated out for real-world use. After 3 months and nearing completion of the task, I was finally told of my post. It was not in Eastern Europe, not in Vietnam. I was told only that I would be traveling north by Jeep Ski, a combination army jeep and snowmobile. A few days later, I was given a set of keys and a child's scribble map that bore hardly any geographic bellwether. Just a few pencil hatchings here and there, and a dashed black line that marked my route that shivered from Fort Alert over the Arctic Sea to my station point, some 500 miles north. My post, I noted, went by the pleasantly benign name of Westbrook, and it lay along a darkly scratched line of mountains or impenetrable wilderness, across which, I supposed, I would not be able to pass. The following morning, as the low sun scoured the feeble yellow sky, I loaded up the back of the jeep ski, floated over the soft airstrip, crunched down over the island's ancient ice until the smooth, huge, solid waft of blue-white, flat ice opened before me. The glinting, the great fallen cloud of the Arctic Sea. And as the ice and snow spread beneath me, and the wild, huge winds razored and splashed all sides of the little jeep with flecks of ice and frozen foam, a little hammer hit a little bell in my little head. And tucked inside that tinkling, wrinkling bell was a soft and exhausted and mysterious little word I could hardly hear, and yet which soon went manipulating at my lips until, as though it was someone else saying it, I heard a voice in the jeep enclosure whispering, "Cancel. Cancel. Cancel."
Thank you.
There was scant detail on my upcoming patrol, as my CO had termed it, but I attempted to put what meager details I had into a helpful treatment, if only to distract myself from the hoodlum nothingness about me. I knew that my tenure at the station had no upward limit. Someday I would be relieved of duty. Could be 1 month, or 1 year, or 5. Of course, they could not force me to accept these terms, but I did. I was grateful, at the time, for the unyieldingness, for the extremity of the demand. I wanted to be treated sternly, harshly, to be sent away, to have to endure. I knew that I would be replacing someone named Errol McCluskey, and I knew that I would be, aside from the initial introductory training with McCluskey, alone. I also knew that the station operator had a curious title, that McCluskey was referred to as the exponent of Westbrook, and that when I relieved him, I would be. As I scuffed and skidded over the frozen sea, I wondered over my soon-to-be title, the exponent of Westbrook. There was something vaguely utopian in the coin of the phrase, something clean and smart and new and idealized, yet without being too dreamy, and unattached to meaning, just a refreshing, unfettered, but still mild expression. My trip would take approximately 10 hours, moving along in a north by northwest direction. I had 15 gallons of gas in the tank, an additional 40 gallons in 2 large black barrels in the back. The interior smelled horribly of oil and spillage. The fuel fumes even seemed to wrinkle the air about my face, giving everything in view the ghostly liquid scrub of a mirage. The jeep ski was quite simple to navigate, and had been jerry-rigged to allow for a kind of automatic pilot. I set the speed at 40 miles per hour, and relaxed my legs, as I was finding it somewhat irritating to have to steer a fastly moving machine over such purely open terrain, with nothing to steer toward, and nothing like a lane or a road to keep one sensible to the task. I found myself dropping my hands from the wheel, and soon I dared myself to slide into the passenger seat. I remained there for the duration of the journey. Every 5 minutes or so, I checked my heading on the dashboard compass. Late afternoon, and I entered a whitewashed delirium. I had snow goggles with me, and I'd been told to wear them, but they itched and bothered my face, and I was so eager for my lonely voyage that I'd thrown them under a tarp on the creosote floor of the jeep, and now found it impossible to fetch them. The whitewashed state soon became a kind of smeared-over state. I had traveled for nearly 4.5 hours without so much as touching the wheel. I was a complete passenger in the vehicle. It was taking me. I was no longer taking it. The sky above hushed and timbered a green forest as evening came. A long snowy crest was rising in the distance dead ahead, but my dim consciousness was too slack to greet it until it scaled upward in size, and I started. What's on the map was depicted by a dark pencil line was a huge, invincible-looking wall of ice stretching east to west. I would not be traveling any further than this wall. Somewhere along its base, I would find my new home, Westbrook. As I approached, the rise continued to loom upward in the sky. My plan was to travel an hour west upon arriving at the impasse, and then, if I still hadn't found the station, to turn around and head 2 hours east. I assumed my navigating, or the jeeps, would have left about this much slack, but my plan was not needed. What I first mistook for a protruding stick or log about a quarter mile from the snow wall became, as I grew near, a ramshackle hut. I drifted to a slow stop beside it and climbed out. The hut door opened, and a pleasant steam whirred out. Errol McCluskey stepped from the hut with a bottle of wine under one heavily garbed arm. He poured and held out a glass, a very dark, very cold-looking wine, and as I reached to take it, he drew his hood down and removed his goggles. "Welcome to Westbrook, Sherwin," said McCluskey. "The most striking and beautiful woman, military or otherwise, that I have ever had the pleasure of seeing." Oh.
heavy round lines. Ta-ra to Sylvie, ta-ra to Jean. We'll soon be on the road. Don't think on what you leave in. Don't think on what you found. Just tear off the toot, pull out the chat, we'll find another ground. Pull down lines, it wasn't a bad ground lines. We've made some brass, you've had a blast. It's perhaps as well we're going. I know how it can hurt, lads, to leave us standing there. For there's often fears, and there's always tears. But you'll be back next year. Sets are cooling down, lads. The arc's all packed and the dodging stacked. A bite of scrand and go. We'll leave it as we found it. They'll soon forget we've been. Oh, we trade in fun and we go and come. We're often scorned and seldom mourned. Oh, I hope you know what I mean.
She had raven hair and olive, oddly tanned skin. I thought she was perhaps Greek or Italian. Her features were so clean and simply drawn, and my mind so haggard, that it was difficult for me to remember her face from one moment to the next, and I found myself staring and staring as though trying to peg it down before it flew away. I wanted to remember her when she left. Errol made a show that the little fishing hut was Westbrook Station itself, and insisted that she'd done her service here. In my travel sick state, I believed her. Given our circumstances, who could lie? It seemed too cold to lie, too perilous to tease. I have been here for 9 years, Sherwin, she said in a somber tone. Yet her voice, even downcast, retained a musical and crystal sharpness, as though reshaped by the cold. I fish, I melt ice, I drink the melt off. I sometimes skate. Skate, I said. It seemed ridiculous. The image was heartbreaking. But how do you keep warm, Errol? I said. How do you do your laundry, Errol? I noted my too soon recurrent use of her name, and banished it for good that I not give away my glimmering heart. No laundry, she said. I just wear this, she patted her cold weather wear. We went into the hut and sat on the narrow bench side by side. A candle burnt on an upended tin can, and I saw that she did indeed have a hole bored in the ice, over which nested a delicate ice-fishing contraption. She opened a fresh bottle of wine. One thing you must really watch out for, Sherwin, she prompted me. Yes, I said. Whales. Sometimes the hook catches hold as they go gliding by. Then they usually just come up to the ice and give a gentle bump. But you better cut that line quick, because the next bump, and you're getting wet. And when I say wet, I mean dead. Goodness, I said. Nearly speechless. I began shaking my head in a kind of universal rejection of all that I'd heard so far. You're wondering why the station is here? For one thing, I said. The station is here, she said enigmatically, because I am stationed here. And now it is here because you are here. She smiled at the tautology. and if I had been undrunk or undrunkly discerning, I would have detected the faint hint of pleasured play in her voice. She shut the door, and a garrulous propane heater began spitting its hot, sick breath over us. "You'll be happy here, Sherwin," she said. She turned away from me and began shaking violently. Later, I understood that she was giggling. "Well," she finally said, standing, "I guess I'll be going." "What?" I said weakly. "What about my training? You can't just leave me here like this, useless and ignorant. Your training is complete. Shack, hole, fish, careful about the whales, no laundry." She climbed into the jeep ski, started it up. "You're kidding," I said. I implored. My shoulders fell and my eyes moistened. I was even starting to sulk. I was truly, deeply sad. She beckoned to me. "Get in, dummy dum-dum," she said, and she shook her head in such a playful way that the sad tears ready at my eyes sprung forth, but in relieving happiness. I stumbled to my passenger side. "I like people who can be fooled," she said when I'd gotten in. "I like trustees." "Trustees," I said. "People who trust." "I'm not a trustee," I said. "I'm just befuddled and agitated by new circumstance." "Oh, you're a trustee, all right. You're trusty old Sherwin, and you're ready to go." "It's a cruel tease, by the way," I said. "Yes," she said, "but it's important for me to check. You'll have to do the same when your replacement comes." "Why on earth would I have to do the same?" "To make sure," she said, "that they're flesh and blood." "As opposed to," I said. She simply widened her eyes further at this and said, "Who knows? Robots?" I saw no sign of Westbrook when Errol pulled the jeep to a halt 10 minutes later. She got out and began walking toward the icy sheer, which rose maybe 200 feet straight up. "We're here," she said. "Really this time. Home. And there is a laundry service, you'll be pleased to hear." I got out, grabbed my bags. Was she serious? I saw nothing that indicated a station. No barracks, no little huts even. I was about to question her further when I heard the unmistakable clang of boot-struck iron. Errol was ascending a whitewashed stairwell that blended almost perfectly with the snow. This zippered up the cliff like a fire escape, and at the top I saw the vague frosty arch of a doorway in the ice. I followed after her. Standing inside Westbrook on the uppermost deck of an enormous cylinder. We walked around the curving catwalk, more to the purpose that I get used to the idea of my new home, as Errol shortly swept us back around. I was surprised at how warm and dry it was, and how dark. There seemed to be a small orange and dim bulb burning every 30 yards, barely diffusing enough to see one's own feet as one walked along. The floor was metal rebar and had the loose, fluffy feel of scaffolding, as though everything were dangled from ropes or propped by tall, weak poles. Our steps reverberated in the deep tube. How far down does it go? I asked, peering over the guardrail into the central black vacuum. 30 stories, Earl said. She pulled open a heavy cargo door along the outside wall. My room, I suppose I could say, our somewhat room, is here. I was relieved by the bright golden incandescence that flooded outward from the room as I stepped in. There was a real warmth here, a spacious but intimate setting. There was room in this room. Room to write, to read. Warm sunny walls gave way to an unexpectedly high ceiling, which dissolved in blues and whites like a fine afternoon sky. With a hard squint, I almost felt myself to be out of doors in some great field, about to join a picnic. Even the scent, a spray fragrance certainly, was of orchards and meadows. An inviting bathroom opened at the back where I could see a towel hanging over a porcelain bath. The furnishings in the room proper consisted of a large bed with a pretty stars and planets print comforter, and beneath it, and beneath our feet, a grass-green shag rug, which again added to the outdoorsy illusion. To my right was a standard plain maple bureau, on top of which stood a fish tank. On the far wall was a table and chair, and in the corner, beside a huge shelf full of dime novels, was a large brown recliner that held on its well-sat cushion a lap blanket. And finally, to my astonishment, in the near adjacent corner, missed entirely until the end of my survey, stood a fairly large tree with a great bloom of greenery, which turned out to be fake, but which yet fully finalized the atmosphere of an English country picnic. The only thing out of place was the two of us, in our harsh weather gear. "Would you like to rest, or would you like a little tour?" Errol asked, stepping out of her boots. Though I regretted it a moment later for sounding rather feminine, I made the compacting comment that I found touring restful. I dropped my bags. I wondered to what level of remove I might make of my own thick winter gear. I unbuttoned my jacket, and was shocked to see that Errol was not only barefoot, but somehow already stripped down to shorts and a kind of sleeveless turtleneck. I dropped off my coat and boots, and, in a woolen sweater and pants, I followed her back out into the great cylinder. I saw on the far wall, in the dim light, a set of bland elevated doors. Beside these, an open stairwell died into the darkness. I assumed that we'd make use of these, as this upper floor seemed to be unto itself. But instead, after a half turn round the rotunda, Errol pulled forward another great door and urged me in. I found myself in what looked like an old-fashioned gentleman's club, with bookshelves, mahogany desks and chairs, and great reading nooks with leather recliners. Errol gestured me toward a huge circular cherry-topped table in the center of the room, and we sat. "There's a book somewhere in these shelves," she said, "that will tell you everything you need to know about Westbrook, and about being the exponent of Westbrook. I won't tell you where the book is, and you likely won't find it before I leave, but inside the book is a key code to the elevator, so you will be allowed to go trudging about down below. Without that, you won't be going down. The stairwell you may have seen leads only to the floor just below us, but it's a duplicate of this floor, except the bedroom and library cannot be entered. Read the book. It answers every question that you have now, and every question that you're likely to have while reading it. As there can be no downtime during this changing of the guards, I must acquaint you with what is, in fact, the only responsibility you will ever have so far as managing the station, aside from staying sane and staying alive, both actually quite challenging in this austere environment. She paused for a moment, and I said nothing. In the event that the waters and ice around Westbrook begin to melt, she continued, you are hereby charged with the duty of releasing the station from its current locks. It's locks, I said. There are 12 locks anchoring the station to the ice. And what happens, I said, when the locks are unlocked? Westbrook will be released, she said. And then what will happen, I asked. I don't know, Errol said. But in the event the locks are released, you will be required to evacuate to the floor just beneath us. The unlocking of the station will also unlock the bedroom and library on the floor below. As you might imagine, there is a second text in that library, which, I assume, will assist you in your next steps. if next steps you are called upon to take, which is very unlikely, Sherwin. I quite realize, I said, although I really did not realize anything. I will shortly acquaint you with the locks and how to release them. It is a momentary training, very simple. But I would appreciate your respecting these conditions. Remember, I once arrived as you did. Your confusion was once my own. I have been in your place as you will, no doubt, some day be in mine. I only wish that we might spend our time more naturally. I have been alone for a long, long time, and would like some friendly company. I won't ask you about the world, which I am eager to learn of, and you won't ask me about Westbrook. Agreed. You're eager to learn about the world, I said, not quite following. Your stay here, Sherwin, will not be marked by anything remotely civilized until you are replaced. You will have no contact with the outside world until that time. And how long have you been here? I asked. 6 years. No newspapers, no radio, no television, no communication, no status reports, nothing. Silence. Beautiful silence, but it's not so beautiful at first. I felt as though we'd been transported back to the giddy fishing hut, and I wondered whether she was being fully honest with me. But a moment later, I heard a question I had never yet heard before in my 26 years. Sherwin, she said, I wonder, would you kiss me?
I shall be loving you through all eternity. But if you don't believe me, wait and see. My heart will still be true when stars on high have flickered out like little candles in the sky. And when the evergreen has withered on, I still will feel the same as I do now. These little words I know can never show how true.
Our night together will remain a private thing. I will only say that the depth of our intimacy was not matched by any physical congress. We kissed and held each other. We slept, and that is all. But the beauty of it was, for me, purely startling. So exhilarating and sharp was the experience. It was as though I had flown up into the sky and become a star. To look at her, to be with her like that, removed every doubt I had about the power and simplicity of life. This was life here, warm, in the palm of her bed. And the following morning, as I walked her down to the jeep ski, I could not help but feel gratitude that I would be, or could be, sustained by this disclosure of the softer world. She smiled and pointed at the gas cans in the back, and I happily fulfilled my role and lifted them out and, over a 10-minute period, filled the jeep's tank. South by southeast, she said. We pressed our cold lips together and embraced, and I was weeping as the sound and sight of the jeep lustered its lonely motor under the horizon. My gone forever, most beautiful, most kind, most loving soldier girl. Thank you. You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.